Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I am talking to Scott C. Davis, publisher of Kuhn Books and author of The Road from Damascus, and also publisher of Carsten Weiland, whose recent book on Syria is very timely, A Decade of Lost Chances. Unfortunately, Carsten is now working for the German Foreign Office and can't talk to us. He's bound by ritual oaths and things like that that diplomats have to do. But this is very timely. Your book list seems to be very Middle East oriented, and Seattle is about as far away from the Middle East as you can get. So could you explain how it came about?
Well, in 1986, I was a writer and not a publisher, and Syria was in the news for a couple of terrorist incidents that was supposed to have been involved in. And I thought, well, gee, my first book, The World of Patience Gromes, was about an African-American community in Richmond, Virginia that won awards. Why don't I do something similar, only very different on the surface? And so I thought, well, what about a travelogue to an enemy nation? And then I thought, well, Syria is the perfect place to go, because if it takes me a long time to write the book, I can count on them still being in trouble 10 or 15 years later. And that's exactly what happened, is that Syria was still, they weren't in the top three of the evil nations of the world, but we made the top seven. Syria made the top seven. So it was still in trouble years later when I published the book, The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria, which is the first travelogue by an American on Syria in more than a century.
Wow, that long.
Yes, it turned out that one of my best friends in Seattle was a guy named Mamoun Sakal, who is an architect, and a friend of mine who is a mountain climbing buddy went to Washington State University, and he met a couple of wealthy Syrians who were studying there at Washington State, getting their degrees in architecture and engineering. And later, my mountain climbing buddy hired these Syrians to work for him, and they brought some Syrian architects over, in this case from Aleppo, the major city in northern Syria. So this is how things work. I got to know Mamoun, who is a fantastic calligrapher and graphic designer, from my mountain climbing buddy. And I thought, hey, Mamoun could give me a lot of contacts, and I would be, you know, get into the Syrian culture much more quickly than if I went to Morocco or Egypt or someplace. And also, he convinced me of how incredible Syria is and was as sort of an untold story. Egypt has the pyramids, it's true, but Syria, everybody that ever invaded the Middle East in history got at least as far as Syria, and they left castles and monuments, and they left people, and they left ideas. So it's really the hinge between Europe and Central Asia and Africa, and you can see it all coming together in Syria.
I mean, I've been Damascus. The Great Mosque in Damascus is a miracle. And one of the stories about the crossroads is that not only did the local Christians welcome the Muslims on their arrival, they actually shared what was then the cathedral with them for a couple of centuries afterwards, as I remember. That later became the mosque, didn't it? Is my recollection correct?
Yeah, that's more or less right. And the Grand Mosque to this day still includes a section dedicated to the Christian St. John, which was left over from the original cathedral. Christians ran the great Muslim empire of the Middle Ages as administrators for the first 100 years, because all the administration was in Greek, you know, which had been the language of the land, thanks to Alexander a few hundred years before. And there are many stories about the tolerant and, you could say, liberal caliph in Damascus who would sponsor debates among different Christian factions. And after he heard both sides doing a presentation, then he would offer his analysis and give tips on how they could bridge their differences.
Yeah, but it's a sort of separate issue, because we come onto it later in both of your books, Carsten's and yours, is that I think in those early years, Islam was seen as a sort of Christian heresy rather than a separate religion, since they both, in the local language, worshipped God, Allah, and the Arabs, the Muslims, venerated the Virgin Mary. In fact, I think there are more references to her virginity in the Quran than there are in the Bible. Better attested if you're a Muslim. But presently, of course, one of the things about the Syria which has come up in the current fracas is this diversity of sects. And you touch, you and Carsten both touch upon it. You've got Syrian Christians, you've got Roman Catholics, you had until recently some Jews, not many left now, but you had Kurds, you had Muslims, Sunni and Shia, and of course the Alawites. I think this is something that sort of people, they keep hearing the Alawite minority. Would you like to hold forth a little and let people know what the Alawites actually stand for? Because they're fairly secretive. It's almost like the Freemasons are running the government, isn't it?
Well, in some ways it is. Here's the big picture. You know, under the Ottoman Empire, Arabic was suppressed, and so Arabs weren't real happy about that. Their culture and language did not really emerge under the Ottomans. It was sort of suppressed. However, the Ottomans did something good, and that was that they ran the Middle East for 500 years, and they scarcely had armed conflict during that time. And we can't go 5 years without a major war, because they, the Ottomans used an empire system, whereas we're using a nation-state system that doesn't work very well, because a nation-state wants to suppress its minorities or homogenize them and is threatening to them. But the empire just says, hey, give us our 10% every year, and you can have your own courts, you can administer justice over your own people, and we're happy to help you ensure your survival as an Armenian group or an Alawite group or a Christian, a different kind of Christian group. So specifically with Alawi, you have a situation where the armies back in those days had to travel on their flocks. If their flocks couldn't and herds could not make it, the army couldn't make it, because they didn't have meals ready to eat and helicopters. They had, you're walking on foot or riding a donkey, and your lunch is trotting alongside of you, and it's a sheep or it's a piece of cattle of some type. You know, I don't think they had beef steers back then, but you could only go as your flocks could go, and the flocks couldn't make it up into the mountains. And the wagons couldn't make it up into the mountains on footpaths. So the people that were running from the caliph were the Christians and the Alawi. And the Christians and the Alawi to this day in Syria are very close. So anyway, the larger point is that Syria has had a minimalist government since 1963, when the Ba'ath Party took over. And they kind of imitated the system of the Ottomans. They said, we don't care if you're a minority, we don't care if you're a Kurd, if you're an Armenian, if you're some type of Christian. You know, we just want to be in charge, and we want to have stability, and we want deference from you. But you can continue to administer your own justice over your own people.
Well, that's the point I think we should point, that's the point we should emphasize about the Ottomans, is that the millet system, as I remember they called it, basically it wasn't about administrating territory, it was about administering people. So the different groups in the empire ran their own affairs. They had their own marriage laws. They had their own family laws. They administered disputes between themselves, amongst themselves. And the state's job, as you said, was to pick up taxes and to look after the sort of major items. But it was in its, it's not something that we associate with the Ottomans, really, but it was a people-centered government rather than a territorial-centered government.
Well, yes, and they were willing to use a very, very different administrative system and administrative rules in different territories where, you know, the alternate approach was more suited to the local people. So the thing here is that the Christians obviously were not Muslims. The Alawi technically are Shia, but the standard 12er Shia consider them to be heretics because their theology mixes too many Christian elements in it. So they think that
we should explain that the 12 Shia are the ones who believe that the hidden, the last caliph disappeared and is still like King Arthur waiting to come back. Am I right again here?
Yeah, Al-Mahdi is going to come and save us. So if you go to Iran, you're surrounded by 12 Shiites, you know, unless you find a few closet Zoroastrians who have hung on all these years. But anyway, so both the Shia and the Sunni regard the Alawi as heretics, and the Alawi and the Christians are hiding up in the mountains where they lived more or less unmolested. Okay, now you have World War One. The French and the British come in, and the French say, well, we're taking Syria and Lebanon. Now, what the French did was they were very grasping after territory, I think. And so they enlarged the Ottoman district of Beirut to include the Bekaa Valley, which had previously been administered as part of Syria. Now, the Bekaa Valley had a lot of Shia in it, and Beirut had a lot of Christians, and the French were trying to say, well, if Syria is taken away from us, we want to keep this fertile Bekaa Valley and dominate it with our connections with the local Christians. And so they did that. And as a result, you had the 15-year-long civil war in Lebanon not too long ago because you had a minority Christian group that was governing a majority Shia Muslim nation due to the people that the French brought in the Bekaa Valley. Okay, so now Syria has lost the Bekaa Valley to Lebanon under the French. In 1939, they gave away Syria's prime port of Alexandretta, which is the port for Aleppo, the primary commercial city. And they gave that to Turkey to keep them out of the war being World War II. So here you have Syria. First, the French take the Bekaa Valley away from them, and then their primary port is taken away from them. And, you know, people in Aleppo, I mean, the city suffered. They had to kind of go over the mountains to Latakia or Lada'iya, as they say, to get their port. So anyway, Syria has this whole mentality that, hey, we're very liberal in taking care of our minorities. When the Armenians are running from Turkey during the Armenian genocide around the time of, again, World War One, the Syrians were happy to accept them. When there is a war in Afghanistan, the Afghans refugees end up outside Damascus. There's crisis in Palestine. Well, Palestinians are just in the news the last couple of days. They're in Syria now. And well taken care of until just recently when Assad bombed them in the Yarmouk district of Damascus. But in any case, all of these different refugees have come to Syria because Syria has continued this Ottoman idea that individual ethnic and minority groups are a good thing. And part of the reason they've continued this is because the government has been Alawi, which is a minority government. So you can see we have democracy. We all want democracy, but in the U.S. and in the West, we don't really think that when we say democracy, a large part of what we're talking about is defense of liberty. In other words, the ability of a minority group to continue unmolested and to ensure its own survival. So in Syria, in about 2006, they did some experiments with democracy because democracy was the wave of the future they'd been hearing after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And so in the engineering syndicate, which is a group of engineers that parcels out government contracts, and you know there's some financial benefit to being in this thing, they had always had a mix of Christian, Alawi, Sunni, and maybe a few Shia engineers. So they elected the syndicate democratically, and lo and behold, every single person elected was a Sunni. There were no Christians. The Christians were completely excluded. So was this a good result? Is democracy good in this case to completely exclude a minority group with 10 or 12% of the country's population from this particular syndicate? Well, I don't think so. And, you know, the government, the Alawi-dominated government, has very carefully gone all the way through all of the administrative councils that have to do with how benefits are parceled out and how rights are protected, and given a slice to every single different minority group, including a couple of different strains of Christians. So some tremendous advantages, if you're interested in liberty, to having a minority government, but that doesn't mean that the majority Sunnis are very happy about it.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today I'm talking to Scott C. Davis, a publisher of Kuhn Books, author of his own book on Syria, The Road from Damascus, and publisher of the most recent and sort of highly topical one, A Decade, Syria, A Decade of Lost Chances, Repression and Revolution from Damascus Spring to Arab Spring by Carsten Weilen. Now, Carsten's book sort of sets out objectively that background, which puts Syria in a whole new perspective for those that haven't been looking at it. But, I mean, he comes down fairly strongly against what's been happening in the last couple of years of repression of the protests. And one of the difficulties is, in the West, as well as believing in nation states, we tend to believe in good guys and bad guys. And so people looking at Syria are looking to identify sort of in a Manichaean way, just like the Zoroastrians, good guys and bad guys, the light and the dark. And of course, it's very difficult since we're talking about shades of gray here, aren't we?
Well, to me, yeah, you could say shades of gray, but it's more like black marbles and white marbles all mixed together, and any bucket has got, you know, a high percentage of both. I mean, you know, they're at least 50-50 in both camps. So it's very difficult. The U.S. Stayed loyal to Bashar for a very, very long time. They did not jump ship as early in this Arab Spring process as, you know, you would have expected. And the reason is because they had a pretty good chance of getting a deal on the Golan Heights, because Syria for the previous 5 years had been, you know, insistent on getting negotiations going. They were making some progress, and the Arab Spring protests, you know, derailed this. So on the other hand, you know, nobody argues that Bashar's regime, and especially the regime before his, dominated by his father, and even more the first 7 years under the triumvirate from 1963 to 1970s, these were, you know, brutal dictatorships. And, you know, if you did something they didn't like, or even if you were just suspected, you could just be disappeared at any moment. And, you know, with slight apology. When Bashar came in, he was Western educated, and Carsten goes into this a lot all through his book, and the end of my book, I talk about it quite a bit too. But Bashar was, you know, a computer guy. He was a high-tech guy. He was a cultural guy. He liked the West. He dated beautiful women in London when he was there. And, you know, when he was named as the dictator, he was just not the type of guy you would think that would make a successful dictator. His older brother had died in a car accident that was, you know, sort of semi-self-induced, because he just got bored waiting for his dad to die so he could take over.
I don't remember much in the way of public mourning for his brother, do you?
Well, I think his brother was actually, you know, very highly regarded. And the thing is, you think, well, gee, the brother was just a prototypical dictator in waiting. Was that such a good thing? But it could be that he would have had the toughness to stand up to the army and the security services, whereas Bashar, coming in with all these great ideas of democracy, found that, hey, the family, the security services, the elite Republican guards, you know, his brother Maher Shaqat, his brother-in-law, his sister behind the scenes, his mom really behind the scenes, his mother, they were happy for Bashar to go out in front of the cameras and talk about democracy, and they were happy to have his advisors, his very brilliant, liberal, Western-educated advisors, come up with the democracy project. And they would announce things, but then they would always get rolled back. And it turns out the items that did not get rolled back were the items on the democracy agenda that involved making a lot of money for the family, some member of the family or the in-group. So, for example, you had universities, private universities, and I just have a hunch there's a lot of money involved in these universities, and a chunk of it goes to the family. They had private banking. This was a new thing in Syria. Well, I've got a hunch that a big chunk of that goes to the family. They opened up the economy because they wanted to liberalize the economy and get away from the state-owned industrial system. But, oh, Rami Makhlouf, you know, the cousin, was given most of the choice bits of this new economy, and of course he's part of the family. He can be trusted not to compete with them politically.
One of the issues here is the mysterious Ba'ath Party, of course, which officially ruled this was the Syrian section of the Ba'ath Party, which was supposed to be pan-Arab, just like Saddam Hussein had the Iraqi branch of the Ba'ath Party. And in both cases, this sort of Arab nationalism, almost national socialism, certainly nationalist socialism, disappeared towards the end of their respective reigns as both Saddam Hussein and al-Assad got their claws on power. Now, at one point, did the Alawis begin to sort of really take over the Ba'ath Party and its operations?
Well, remember that Ba'athism was born in Damascus, so it's not just the branch, it's the headquarters. And there was a guy named Michel Aflaq, who was a Christian, and he came up with this sort of a socialist approach. And he said, well, I can speak in front of all of you Muslims because I'm a participant in Muslim culture, even though I'm a Christian. And he was not a very tall guy, but he was eloquent, and he came up with this sort of a socialist approach, which needs to be understood in comparison to what came before, which what came before was you had merchant families in the major cities. Like my mountain climbing buddy went to college with two guys whose families were from Aleppo, and they owned villages outside of Aleppo. It was medieval. They owned the villages, they owned the land, and they owned the people. Okay, and it wasn't until, you know, after World War II that there was land reform and this sort of thing was broken up. But it was a very old and medieval and anarchic system. And so the socialist approach is, how much different is that from, you know, socialism in Western Europe? I don't know. So the appeal, however, the emotional appeal was, well, we're all Arabs and we ought to unite as Arabs. And
well, this obviously had an appeal to minorities because it meant that instead of being a minority, they were part of a wider body politic, because the Muslims did it on confessional grounds. I mean, the Turks had run the empire on confessional grounds. You could speak Turkish, but if you were a Christian, you were a Greek as far as they were concerned, and vice versa. If you were a Muslim who spoke Greek, you were a Turk. So, I think it's something to bear in mind that the whole idea of nationality was something that had to be imported from Western Europe, as you said earlier.
Well, you know, and Nasser was the great god of, you know, Arab nationalism, and of course, we had the Cold War going on, and we said socialism, well, that's the next thing, next closest thing to communism, so we definitely don't like this. But hey, dial forward 20 or 30 or however many years, it's been 40 years, and now we're thinking, oh yeah, a few communists and socialists, that's not a problem. What we are worried about is the, you know, Osama bin Laden guys, the Al-Qaeda guys, the Sunni extremists, you know, the Salafi, these really crazy people that are running around cutting off people's heads and taking hostages and everything. So, you know, you should be careful what you wish for if you're wishing to get rid of the Ba'ath Party and the idea of Arab nationalism. Just be wondering what is going to replace it, which brings us front and center to what's going on in Syria today, yesterday, tomorrow, and that we have this Assad regime. It's a minority regime, which has the benefit that as a minority, they are ensuring civil rights and protection for the Christians, for the Druze, and for all kinds of minorities, even the Kurds, whom they've had a long antagonistic relationship with. But even the Kurds are staying out of the battle because they feel that they can deal with the current regime, and they aren't sure about the new folks coming in. And primarily, these Kurds are concerned about the Al-Qaeda elements of the opposition. So the U.S. is in this strange situation. We hung with Bashar a few crucial weeks longer than we probably should have, because he was capable of doing a deal with the Israelis, and he was making
that was you've just brought in the hidden dimension, is that everything we see about Syria is usually seen through the prism of Tel Aviv rather than its own inherent value.
I want to live a long life, so I'm not going to go too deep into that one. So, but anyway, so on the face of it, sure, we don't like Bashar because he's an evil dictator and has been for, you know, his family for over 40 years, but the thing is, it's a secular regime. It's got some window dressing on the Arab nationalist front, sort of a socialist cast, but they're absolutely not the Al-Qaeda types, and they're absolutely locked in combat against any kind of Sunni fundamentalism. Okay, that's one good thing. The other good thing is protection of minorities. Christian churches were protected. The Armenians were protected during the pogroms. You know, well, what's happening now with a primarily, I think Al-Qaeda is still a very, very small part, but the al-Nusra Front is, you know, the most effective group of fighters. But the core of the insurgency is not the Western-oriented civil society college students who protested in Damascus. It's the folks in Daraa, in Hama, in Homs, in the middle of the country and in the south of the country, who were Sunni, who were faithful, conservative people, just like, you know, in the middle of the U.S.
The Midwest, yes. Look, Scott, I'm sorry, that's all we have time for. Comparing the Midwest of Syria to the Midwest of the United States might get you in trouble in other places. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been talking to Scott C. Davis, publisher of Kuhn Books and author of The Road from Damascus, and publisher most recently of Syria, A Decade of Lost Chances by Carsten Weiland, a German who spent a lot of time in Syria researching this. Thanks very much, Scott.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.